Our members here, then you know that we've been preaching through the Bible with the 17 time periods. If you're a member here, we have already studied the three time periods before the flood, and the scattering of the people afterward. And now we're getting into the patriarchs, or the patriarchal age of the Bible. And this extends from Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 50, so to the end of the book. And in chapters 12, you'll notice there's a little bit of overlap here. In 12 through 25 verse 11, we have Abraham. And of course, 25 verse 11 is when Abraham dies. Then 24 and verse 15 to 35 verse 29, we have Isaac. And he actually takes up a relatively small portion of that that grouping in there, but until his death in chapter 35, verse 29. And then Jacob is noticed very soon after Isaac starts, but he takes up a much larger chunk, especially during Isaac's time here. And then from 37 and verse 3 to 50, verse 26, I chose here Joseph, but really it could be any of the 12 sons of Jacob. But of course, Joseph plays the most prominent role after that. And then the book of Genesis ends. But if you just say this is what the Bible talks about the patriarchal age, you might be missing a portion. Because this is also the age that we find Job. And we'll talk about why we put Job in the patriarchal age. I'm going to try not to make this first part about the introduction of Job to be too dry, but it does, I think, help some to have some answers to these questions, particularly where Job really comes from and when he is found. Because people say, well, why the patriarchal age? Well, let's talk about some of that for a moment. And after we talk about sort of this introduction to Job, then we'll go through an outline of the book of Job, and then we'll talk about some practical points at the end. So all we know is that Job is from the land of Uz, is how you're supposed to pronounce that. So thank you, Matt, for pronouncing that correctly. But again, we Americans just love to call it Uz. And I grew up singing a song, Nobody Knows Where the Land of Uz Was. It's a nice little rhyme. But technically in Hebrew, it is Uz. So that's where we find ourselves in Job chapter 1, verse 1. And of course, if I didn't say it before, if I neglected to say it, which I think it's obvious at this point, we're going to be spending our time in Job, and then next week we'll go through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We might even have to take some time for ourselves even then. We might have to split that up into a couple of parts. But here in Job 1, verse 1, we have this introduction to where we are. My pages are sticking together. I apologize. A man in the land whose name was Job, that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. It kind of tells us who he is in these first few verses here. Of course, we don't know where this land is. In fact, there are two people that go by the name of Uz. We find one in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 23 as one of the descendants of Shem, and more specifically of Shem's descendant Aram. And we'll talk about that in just a minute, why that's at all important and who the Arameans are. And then you also find the name in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 21. And he is actually a nephew of Abraham. And so we don't know whether or not it's even named after either of these men. At this point in history, that's generally how we name lands, was after a person who inhabited that land. And so most biblical scholars will point to 10 verse 23 as the likelier source rather than 22 and verse 21. And it says that Shem back here in Genesis chapter 10, his descendants settled in the east. And so we see that here at the start. I lost my place here for a moment. There it is, verse 3, the greatest of all the men of the east. And again, this is the family of Aram. The Arameans are generally who we know them as, the Syrians. The people who inhabit the land of Syria are the Arameans. And also based on what this means. Technically, it means wooded, but there are second and third century scholars who say that's not actually what the word means. That's neither here nor there, really, at the end of the day. However, what we do notice, I put this little thing here, Buzite or Bootsite. And why do I have that here? Well, we'll get to that. One of the friends, one of Job's friends, is called a Bootsite. And back here in 22 verse 21, Uts has a brother named Boots. So it might be that we're actually more along the lines here, that these are actually descendants of Uts and Boots, who are Abraham's nephews, sons of Abraham's brother Nahor. Okay? And there's only two places in the rest of the Bible that mention this as a place, which is Jeremiah 25, verse 20, just says, the kings of the land of Uts. It doesn't really give us any more than that. But in Lamentations chapter 4, verse 21, he says that the daughters of Edom dwell in the land of Uts. Now, for Moses writing this, that the Edomites were just beginning to be established, considering he's a descendant of Israel. But this is where this term Idumean comes from. It comes from Edomite. And we know that the Edomites settled in what was typically called the south. So it wouldn't be Edom specifically, but Edom, the Idumean empire, if you will, expanded north into what we call Aram or Syria, that Damascus area. And so, again, that seems to be a callback in Lamentations 4, verse 21. This is the only verse in the entire Bible that sort of gives us a generally good understanding. But even then, it's all really conjecture. But the more important question is when? Because even growing up, it was always, oh, Job is one of the patriarchs. And I was like, why? It doesn't say that we are or anything, but again, it's helpful to know some of the research behind it, as well as in-text hints at when we're dealing with things. So I will say it is most likely the patriarchal age. The first piece of evidence that I'm going to offer to you is what I think is the weakest. Out of all of them, there are some biblical scholars that disagree with me, that think this is very strong. But it's the idea that there is no reference to either the Exodus or the conquest of Canaan, which books that come after will almost always reference one or both of these events. And so for a lot of biblical scholars, that means something to me. The Holy Spirit may not have felt like putting it in there. So again, that's reason for some biblical scholars, but that one's a little bit harder for me. However, when you actually look, there are sacrifices that are offered by Job. It doesn't show anything about there being priests involved. It says Job would send and consecrate them, rising early in the morning and offering burnt offerings. The way that the Hebrew there is worded is that Job is the one doing the offerings, and not a priest, which would mean we're at a time before the law of Moses. And then later on, here in chapter 42, it's hinted that we do this again. And then looking at this very context here, this is actually God telling Job's friends, ask Job to pray for you. And this harkens back to Genesis chapter 20 and verse 7, There is a king by the name of Abimelech who takes Sarah, Abraham's wife, because Abraham said she's my sister, which is half true, but neglected to inform him that it was his wife. And so God threatens to punish Abimelech and his people if he doesn't give Sarah back. And then God tells Abimelech, ask of him because he is a prophet and he will pray for you. It sounds sort of similar to each other, which again would lead me to believe that we are most likely in the patriarchal age. Something I neglected to put on this list is whether or not Job is a real person. And all I have to say is he is mentioned in the prophets and in the New Testament. So that leads me to believe he's a real person. That's enough for me. But there is other evidence to give for the probability of him being a real person. But the Bible references it, and that's good enough for me. All right, the outline of Job as it stands. We are going to actually make our way through the entire book, but I promise we're not reading one verse at a time. Someone would be falling out of a window and dying if I stayed here that long. But here in the first five verses, we are introduced to Job and the kind of character that he has. So the first is, he is blameless, he is upright, he fears God, and he turns away from evil. I love the both of those. Those must be together. It's not enough to simply fear God, and it's not enough to simply turn away from evil. We have to be doing both of those things. And of course, if one truly fears God, he will turn away from evil. But I like that the Holy Spirit makes them separate entities here. We see that he has 7 sons, 3 daughters. He is incredibly wealthy. Thousands of sheep and camels, hundreds. Notice here it says 500 yoke of oxen, which means we're talking about at least pairs. So that would be 1,000 oxen. 500 female donkeys, many servants. And then, of course, calls him the greatest of all the men of the East. And then his sons, he had 7 sons. So each day of the week was dedicated to another son having a feast at his house. So think about that. You're having a feast every week. That also means his sons are very wealthy, whether that's handed down from Job or whether that's their own wealth, I'm not sure. But that is extremely wealthy. That is what we would call in America filthy rich. But here verse 5 is where we were already told blameless, upright, fearing God, turning away from evil. But here we have a real example of it in verse 5. So Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning for his children. And he would consecrate them and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. I mean, he has to rise up early in the morning at the very least because this would have been a tedious task. But he rises up early so that it can be done and his children are consecrated. And then I love his response here. Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. And so he wants his children to understand righteousness with their God. It seems to me that's what he's striving to teach them. And so we see a very practical understanding of what was already said of him in verse 1. Now, starting in verse 6, we already have some difficulty for many people. We start in verse 6, there was a day when the sons of God, in the Old Testament, that phrase typically means that these are angels or spirits coming to the throne of God. That's what it means by coming to present themselves before the Lord. And what gives people pause is it says Satan comes among them. So Satan seems to be at the throne of God. And there's been lots of debates about this. Some that people have debated me personally about this. It doesn't call him a Satan. The Satan is called the adversary. It is a fairly generic term in Hebrew, but here it's denoting a specific character. And it seems to be tied to all other versions of the specific word, which would be who we call the devil. Okay? So the adversary comes among them, and God actually engages him. "From where do you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." So Satan means the adversary, but also means the accuser. And so it seems that perhaps the connection here is he's roaming about on the earth to find accusation against men. And before he has a chance to say anything else, God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." That is very high praise from the Lord. And then Satan seems to know who this is because he engages in a conversation with God directly about Job, knows who he is. Does Job fear God for nothing? That's the real question. That's the question that we're going to strive to answer throughout the entire book. Does Job fear God for nothing? And, of course, we know the answer because we have the end of the book. The end of the book is, no, he doesn't fear God for nothing. It is a well-founded fear and reverence. But, as we'll also see looking through the book, everyone has their limits. And so Satan says, "Well, look, of course you gave him all of these riches. Of course he's happy with you." I mean, imagine somebody just giving you wealth on wealth on wealth. Of course he'll love you. So he says, "Put forth your hand." So he's actually speaking to God. "Okay, put forth your hand and touch all that he has." But then God delegates it to Satan. And he says, "All right, you do it, but do not put forth your hand on him." So you can do whatever you want, just don't affect Job himself, okay? And so Satan departs from the presence of the Lord, the presence of Yahweh. That's the tetragrammaton there. And then we start verse 13. Starting in verse 13, we see what Satan decides to do to Job, which is take away all of his riches. There are raiders that come in and take all of his flocks and his cattle. And then there's this storm that comes and destroys the house that all of the sons and daughters are eating and drinking in. And the big thing is all of this comes at Job one after the other. Just boom, 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 boom. It says while the other was still speaking, that another one runs up and tells him about the next thing. And so he loses everything in a matter of seconds. And it would have been bad enough to hear it slowly over the course of the day, but here he is just kicked in the teeth. But notice what Job does in verse 20. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshiped. If we didn't know the kind of person Job was before, now we really know. In the middle of all this, most of the time what we like to do in our modern age, if something this horrible happened, we've got a finger going right up at God. How could you do this to me? But that's not what Job does. He falls down and worships. And this verse 21, is my favorite verse in the entire Bible. "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Look, God gave it all to me, and he felt like he should take it away. And then verse 22 is also very important. "Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God." I mean, he does say the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away, but this idea of blaming God is not, I'm angry and I'm going to castigate you for what you've done to me. Well, we have a repeat at the beginning of chapter 2. Here, Satan comes back. Satan answered the Lord, "I've been roaming around on the earth, walking around on it." And God brings up Job again. Well, because Of course God's going to bring up Job. Hey, what you did didn't work. He's still my faithful servant. And so Satan says, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now, touch his bone and his flesh, he will curse you to your face. So, well, of course, yeah, I've taken away all his riches and his family, but I haven't touched him yet. He still has his health, so he still has a reason to be thankful. So notice here God says, okay, go for it. Try it out. Well, then in verse 7 through 10, Satan goes out from the presence of the Lord and smote him with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. He's trying to get the boils off by scraping his skin, which they were already painful enough. Imagine trying to make contact and slicing them off with something sharp. Now his wife joins in Satan's ploy. His wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. Can you imagine your spouse saying that to you? So after everything, he's lost all of his wealth. He's lost his family. He's lost his health. He's in incredible pain. And now your wife, the last bastion of hope in your life, besides the good Lord, is now saying, just forget about him and die already. He said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Look, God has given me so many blessings. I'm going to be mad when bad times come? Again, an incredible statement of faith. And then verse 11 through 13. Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that had come upon him, and they came each one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And then we're going to find out later, there is actually one more, Elihu, who is here, but it just mentions these three at first. They made an appointment together to come and sympathize with him and comfort him. Again, I didn't want to add on to how dry the first part might have been, but it's very difficult to navigate who these men are and where they really come from. It is very, very difficult to ascertain, especially when you consider, for instance, Shuhite and Naamathite. This is the only time you see those words, so it makes things very difficult. But do some of your own research on that if you're interested. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. Each of them tore his robe. They threw dust over their heads toward the sky, and they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. I do think that is a literal 7 days and seven nights. We're in the narrative part here. We haven't gotten to the poetry of the book yet, but that is, I will just say here, that is my opinion, and I don't think it matters either way whether it's a literal 7 days or not. They are giving him time to grieve, and that's what's important. But can you imagine, after going through all this, of course you're going to look different than you would have looked when you were healthy and everything was going well for you. But that's how much Satan has brought down Job's life upon him. And then in chapter 3, Job gives this loud lament. Verse 3, I think, sort of sums up the despair of it all. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. May that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Basically, oh, that I were never born. And then here, starting in chapter 4, all the way through to chapter 31, is we have this discourse between Job and his three friends. If you start looking with me in the book, chapters 4 and 5 are Eliphaz, and Eliphaz is the one who speaks first after Job gives his lament. And of course, in Job's lament, he mentions how he doesn't know what he's done to deserve this. And in fact, he states, "I haven't done anything to deserve this," which he's right. He's right that he hasn't done anything to deserve this. But Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar do not seem to agree. And so Eliphaz starts off with, "Hey, look, the innocent don't suffer. God doesn't allow the innocent to suffer," which is not entirely true. Especially up to through the book of Genesis, that has not been the case, that the innocent never suffer, because tribulation comes upon us all, just as the rain and the sunshine come upon us all. God gives us all a chance to respond to him, gives us all good things, not just the righteous. But no, the innocent do suffer from time to time, and Job is, he doesn't know it, but is going to be one of the foremost examples of this. But, and Eliphaz does rightly point out in chapter 5, well, God is just, which he's right. God is just. And so now we have this, we have the first part of this conflict. Look, we've been sitting here 7 days, 7 nights. I'll be the first to say it. Job, this doesn't happen to good people. God is just, and you've done something to deserve it. Which, talk about what you think is the truth, but man, that is a strong statement to make right out of the gate about a man who is in this much pain. But then in chapter 6 and 7, Job responds to Eliphaz's words, but he mostly centers around the idea that life is futile, which is also true. This is something that Ecclesiastes thinks is worth mentioning. It is what the entire book is about. Life is futile without God. Then chapter 8, Bildad joins in and says, no, God rewards the good. Eliphaz is right. The innocent don't suffer. God rewards the good, and he punishes the bad. And Job answers in chapters 9 and 10, and here we see the first sort of discordant thing that Job says. This is the first time he really mentions just how much spiritual difficulty he's really having with this. And he says that there is no arbitrator between man and God. Man can do what, or God can do whatever he wants. And there's nothing that I can do to change his mind. And then in chapter 10, he talks about how I don't understand how God makes the choices that he makes. Sorry, Job, that's all of us. I don't know how God makes the choices that he makes. But one thing I do know, God is going to make the best choices for all involved. Because God knows what's best. And apparently here, allowing this to happen to Job was what God thought was best. Chapter 11, Zophar now joins the conversation here, but instead of trying to talk about God and sort of give things on a more general plane here, he just straight up rebukes Job and says, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, then Job comes back in chapters 12 through 14 and says, no, I think it's you who don't know what you're talking about. He calls the Proverbs that they state ashes. That's all they're good for, is to be ashes swept up and thrown away. But what's interesting here is in chapter 13, he says that he knows that he will be vindicated in front of the Lord, which turns out to be somewhat right. And then in chapter 14, talks about the finality of death. In chapter 15, Eliphaz is going to return to the conversation, and he tells Job that he presumes too much, and then he gives basic observations about life that sort of echo what he said before. The innocent don't suffer, and God is, in fact, just. And he gives observations that he has seen in life of where that is true. Job then in verses 16 and 17 says the truth of his heart. I'll say it that way. He says, you are all such sorry comforters. Sorry comforters are you all. Which I do have to give him that. But I will say this for his friends. If they really are concerned about his spiritual well-being, I understand how the discourse is taking place. But I will say as well, God will have his time of giving opinion about how Job's three friends have handled this time. And we'll see that at the end. And then Job says that God has shattered him and he's nothing but a byword to everyone else. Everything has gone away from him. 18, Bildad comes up and he talks about the wicked and how God deals with the wicked. Job then comes back in chapter 19, insulted. How dare you insult me in this way? I know what I've done before the Lord. Everything is against me, but this is also where we get our song, I know that my Redeemer lives. And so you see this battle in Job's mind. You're sitting here telling me that I've done something wrong. I'm telling you I haven't done anything wrong to deserve this. But I know that my Redeemer lives. And I know that I will be vindicated. Zophar comes back in chapter 20 and says, that might be, but if that's true, it'll be short-lived. Because the triumph of the wicked is short-lived. And then Job in chapter 21 answers Zophar, but says, yes, God will deal with the wicked. But he'll deal with the wicked in his own way. And I don't think I'm one of them. Eliphaz then in chapter 22 comes back and he both accuses and exhorts Job in what's been happening. And then in chapters 23 and 24, Job is going to respond talking about how much he longs for God. He feels that God has departed from him, which is absolutely understandable. He is wrong, but it is understandable that he would feel this way. And he will learn soon enough that is not the case at all. God is very much near him. And then this is where Job first speaks, I'll put it this way, in opposition to God. Because here in chapter 24, he says, God seems to ignore the wrongs of others. And here is where his internal struggle and the battle that he's had with his three friends at this point is beginning to come to a head. Well, you know what? I don't think God knows how to deal with wrongdoers because now he's come to me and he's dealing with me and this isn't fair. And again, you want to understand Job, but now we've really taken things a step too far. And Bildad rightly in chapter 25 points out, now hold on, man is inferior to God. You don't have a right to say that, which he is right. And then in chapter 26 through 31, Job goes on a very long diatribe against his friends and somewhat against the Lord as well, even though, again, we see the struggle because on one hand he's saying, I don't understand why you're doing this to me. But then in other times, he talks about the greatness of God. He also affirms his own righteousness. He talks about the search for wisdom. He talks about his own past and his present. But in both, there's twice it happens in this context here where he talks about his own uprightness and integrity. I have not done anything to deserve this. Which, the difficulty here is he's right. But what Job isn't taking into account is that he does not know what's going on the other side of the curtain. And so while he's right, he's now taken it to the wrong ends. And what's interesting is at this moment, after he's had this diatribe, and he basically starts calling upon God, he says, I will ask him and he will answer me. And that's where God says, okay, I've heard enough. But before he has a chance, before God has a chance to say anything, there's this man, Elihu, that chimes in here in chapter 32. We have no idea who this man is. Of course, as I pointed out earlier, we never saw him enter the picture, but clearly he's been sitting there because he is going to have the next six chapters, 32 through 37, to talk about each one of them and how you don't at all know what you're all talking about. You all have completely missed the point. And at first, he actually rebukes Job. And then he claims to speak for God. The things that he says are true. They're truthful statements. And so when he's done, God is going to sort of chime in on the back of what Elihu says. So it seems that God is perhaps behind him. So when he says he claims to speak for God, that he really is. But that's not enough for the Lord. He's going to come and speak to Job personally. He does vindicate God's justice. He goes further to reprove Job. He talks about how God deals with men, and then he uses this kind of curious idea here, is that God is the back of the storm. And what he means by that is the storm comes through, but then God is coming behind it. And what God does in the aftermath of the storm is up to him. He could either pick up the pieces, or he can affirm what action he has taken. So that's sort of the idea of God as the back of the storm. And then God comes in 38. So when he's done, I'll read the last few verses of what Elihu has to say here. Chapter 37, verse 21. Men do not see the light which is bright in the skies, but the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes golden splendor. Around God is awesome majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is exalted in power, and he will not do violence to justice and abundant righteousness. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise of heart. And then God now comes and says, all right, thank you, Elihu. I'll speak now. And notice it says he answers Job. He doesn't have any commentary to add to what Elihu says. He answers what Job said. And essentially he says, how dare you? Which is an interesting start for the Lord. A Lord who's abundant in mercy and compassion and loving kindness starts off with, how dare you speak to me like this? And he's right. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you instruct me. And if you're not terrified of the Lord right now, I don't think you read that right. Because if God said that to me, I probably would have fainted. But I guess Job is made of sterner stuff because he has the time to listen to the Lord. And starting here, there's this discourse that happens between the two of them. God talks about his mighty power and what he has done by laying the foundations of the world. And then he talks about his creation in verse 39, or chapter 39, excuse me. So he talks about how he has made creation. And then he said, and there's this sarcasm that keeps coming up with God. Oh, you are there with me. Tell me how this works. And of course, Job has no answer because he doesn't know what God has really done. But after God has thoroughly put him in his place, and he's not done yet, verses 1 through 5 of chapter 40, the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. All right, you reproved me. Now it's time for you to put your money where your mouth is. Tell me. Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken and will not answer even twice, I will add nothing more. That's absolutely right, Job. You are a speck, less than a speck, in the power and glory and splendor of God. But notice here, God doesn't necessarily view Job the same way. Because he's been watching. And he's taken great pains to care for Job. And all is not lost. But God is going to make sure Job never forgets this lesson. Verse 7, gird up your loins like a man, I will ask you and you will instruct me. Okay, let's go again. Let me make sure you understand this. And he goes in to talk about his mighty creations. Specifically in verse 15 of chapter 40, and then in verse 1 of 41, we see two called the Behemoth and the Leviathan. We have no idea what they are. People have tried to imagine what they are. I'm not going to bother with that tonight because I don't think it's helpful. But there have been lots of ideas about what the Behemoth and the Leviathan are. All you need to know is man does not compare to them in power. And God made them. If you're terrified of them, what do you think about the God who made them? And then chapter 42, and verses 1 through 6, Job says, all right, I get it. He repeats God's question in verse 3, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear now, when I will speak, I will ask you and you will instruct me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I retract and I repent in dust and ashes. That's all God wanted to hear. You're right. I'm sorry. And what I love to point out to people that sometimes escapes people's notice is, where did God give Job an explanation of anything? By the way, Satan came and asked me to strike you, and you know what? I let him. No, that God doesn't say any of that. He just says, how dare you not trust me? How dare you not let me be the sovereign of your life? Look at everything I've made. How it is made with wisdom and with power. If I can do all of that, surely I know what I'm doing in your life. But God's not done. He's done with Job. Because he's gotten out of Job what he wanted, which is repentance. But in verse 7 through 9, it came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite. So notice he points out Eliphaz here, but he says, for against you and your two friends. So God decides he doesn't want to speak to Zophar and Bildad. But he speaks to Eliphaz, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Interesting. Job did say things that were wrong about the Lord, but now he's answered for them. But there were things that Job said that were correct. Therefore, take for yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job will pray for you, for I will accept him, so that I may not do with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. And they obey. They go and they do what God asked. And it says, the Lord accepted Job. I find this part interesting. If you sacrifice to me, I'm not going to take it. But I will take if Job sacrifices it for you. Which is interesting. And then in the last few verses here, God restores to Job, In fact, he doesn't just restore it. He gives him twofold of what he had before. It just says he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. We have no idea. I've had this question asked me many times. Are they resurrected or are they new sons and daughters? I don't know. It says Job lives another 140 years. Again, another clue here that this might be from the patriarchal age. And he says he lives to see four more generations. So I don't know if these are new sons and daughters or resurrected ones. And again, not really sure that it matters. But it says Job died an old man and full of days. He learned his lessons about the Lord. So this is the general outline of the book of Job. Again, if we had really broken it down and taken, I probably could have made the entire book of Job one theme for the entire year. But please go and read some of what we glanced through for yourself. Many interesting things said from the friend's perspective, but I want to focus on some practical lessons before we leave, and everything will be yours. First off, Job is righteous. Job is righteous at the very beginning. It's not until he's pushed, and that's no justification. He should have kept to what he believed about God at the start. But through the discourse between him and his friends, he slipped away from that, and he allowed the things said to get between him and the Lord. But when this all begins, he is righteous, and at the end of it, God accepts his repentance. God points out Job to Satan, and it's not the other way around. Oh, look at this guy, so righteous. How about I deal with him? God says, look, I know who my righteous people are, and I'm willing to defend them before you, Satan. The perhaps most important practical lesson that I want us to leave with here tonight is God either tests us in our innocence or punishes us in our iniquity, but it doesn't matter which, because we should always draw near to God. That has to be our response. If he's punishing me, I draw near to him and ask for forgiveness. If it is in my innocence, then I come to him and say, I still have a relationship with you, and I'm drawing near to you, whether in good or in bad. The next is be better friends than Job's. There are lots of things that they say to Job, some of it true, some of it perhaps in misunderstanding. God seems to think there was quite a bit of misunderstanding in what the friends said about him. But now was the time to help Job. And simply just saying, well, clearly you're an evil man, was perhaps not the most helpful in the time. I said this one was perhaps the most important, but this next one is perhaps tied. Know your place. Know your place with him. He is better than us. He knows what is right. He knows what is wrong, what is good, what is evil. He knows what we need, and he knows how to provide it. Any being capable of creating the wonderful universe that's around us surely knows how to guide you through life and when to allow tragedy to befall you. Certainly, he knows what to do. And we don't. We are simply outside of our scope. Tonight, you have a chance to follow Job's example. Sometimes what we find ourselves in is we find ourselves sort of at the end of what Job is saying, and we were never really at the start. That we want to just shake our fist at God and say, life isn't fair, and how could you let all this happen? But God knows what he's doing. And if you come to him, you can learn that. You can learn that God knows what he's doing. And so Of course, what will your answer be? Well, what's the question? Are you going to make your life right with him? Are you going to come and have your sins cleansed? If you are already baptized, are you going to come back to the mediator? Remember, Job said, there is no mediator between man and God. Well, there is now. Jesus Christ. His blood being what ties the two together. He is the mediator. And as long as we are faithful to him, we always have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Do you need him to advocate for you tonight? If so, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.